Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another Naked Englishman podcast. I'm Richard Vobes. This is the behind-the-scenes story of my life, etc. On the 6th of August, 2025. It's just after 6 in the morning. And it promises to be a lovely day again. It's a bit sort of misty at the moment, but it is only 6 o'clock. And I'm aware that we're in August, and of course we're on the slow descent now, away from the 21st of June, which was the summer solstice. So it's not always possible to sort of predict what the weather is going to be like at this early juncture, because the sun is barely up. By 7 o'clock, maybe 8 o'clock, you could sort of get an idea. My dad used to say that whatever the weather is doing, if it's doing whatever it is, in other words, if it was, say, sunny or wet, by 11 o'clock in the morning, it's set for the whole day. If it doesn't change by then, you've got that for the rest of the day. I don't know where he came up with that concept, but it did seem to prove pretty good. Although we've had plenty of wet days, and then it's cleared up by 3 in the afternoon. But perhaps by 3 in the afternoon, it's too late, really, to take advantage of it. You know, my dad always used to love to... We lived in Horsham. And he always used to love to go down to Worthing, where we are now, to enjoy the sea. So I guess it's, well, back then it was probably a 45-minute journey in a Morris Traveller. But it's probably only a half an hour journey now. Horsham to Worthing is 20 miles, so yeah, probably about 30 minutes. Although maybe 45 minutes, depending on all the blimmin' traffic that we have these days and the cones and hold ups, and you know, they seem to be digging up the road for no particular reason, and or if they're digging up the road for whatever reason, they decide 3 months beforehand they'll put all the cones out so that everybody is slowed down. I think it's all a deliberate policy, of course, just to make driving a car as uncomfortable as possible, so that these nutters in government can say, "Ah, look, you won't need a car because it's just too damn awkward." Anyway, I think it's going to be a nice day today. Julia and I saw a tree yesterday, and we were looking at the leaves, and we were desperately trying to work out what it was, and I've only just thought about it this morning. I said it was a hornbeam, but it might not be. I meant to look it up yesterday, but I didn't. Now, I've got all these various books on trees, and you could just look it up. I think there's apps, isn't there, these days? There's apps you can buy, or download, rather, and you can, you know, photograph the leaf and say what kind of tree it is, and it will ping up. But I've got books, and the whole thing about having books is an active activity, to hunt for it, and everything's made just too easy, isn't it? It's all too easy. You just do this, oh yeah, that's what it is, and you move on, and then you probably forget. But I think that the act of pulling a book off the shelf, opening it up, trying to find the blimmin' thing, finding it, etches on the mind more for memory purposes what that leaf is, or that tree, for longer time than just getting used to photographing it and it pinging up. Because effectively you don't use your memory. That's how I look at it. Now, I've got this lovely book called The New Silver. And it's not silver as in S-I-L-V-E-R. This is S-Y-L-V-A. And it's an updated version of one written by, I've got to remember who it was, that chap who was writing at the time of, in 1664. Oh yes, 350 years ago in 1664, a book titled Silver, written by the diarist and intellectual John Evelyn, was published by the Royal Society in London. Silver, from the Latin forests, helped change perceptions of trees and forests and inspired generations of landowners to manage better their woodlands, serving as one of the earliest practical manuals on silviculture. The New Silver, published to mark the anniversary of Evelyn's work, celebrates mankind's relationship with trees through an integration of history, science and art. This much-needed contemporary and scholarly review is inspired by Evelyn's words and philosophy, and it honours his poignant plea for change by introducing the true nature of sustainable forest to a modern audience. Anyway, I'm not sure I like the word sustainable, but that probably is before it was pinched by the globalists, the WEF, to mean your death. You know, there's some mealy-mouthed words, aren't there? Sustainable is one of them, which used to have a proper meaning. That was, sorry, I'm just moving the microphone now. Let's have a slurp of coffee. So, anyway, it's a beautiful, it's a big book. I can't remember if that was came out in 1664. Well, it didn't come out. This came out, I think it came out either in 2000 and, well, I don't think I've had it since 2004, maybe 2014. It didn't come out in 1964, so I wonder how many years it is. Anyway, it's a big tome of a book, and I remember it cost me £40. It was very expensive. But I was determined to have it because it's beautifully illustrated in line, what do you call it? Pen and line. I just want to finish my coffee. And then I'm going to have a hunt through for this hornbeam. But yes, and of course, when I was doing the Bald Explorer, it was very useful. It's not as well thumbed as perhaps it ought to be. In other words, it sat on the shelf saying, you've spent a lot of money on this book and you're not using me enough. But I think it's one of those books for life, which is just very beautiful. And if you're into books, that's the thing. As a gorgeous object, it is one of those gorgeous objects. It's not leather bound, but it is very lovely, and it's extremely heavy. Right, what else can I tell you before I look for that? Oh yes, 2014 it came out. That's when I bought it. I must have heard it. I think I heard it on Radio 4. When I was an avid listener of the BBC, before the BBC went weird. Even though it was marginally biased back then, it went extremely weird. John Evelyn was a virtuoso, polymath and luminary in the 17th century Britain. As a founding member of the Royal Society, he was at the heart of the unfurling scientific revolution. He had close ties to the royal court and Charles II, and counted among his friends prominent figures in society, including the chemist Robert Boyle, architect Sir Christopher Wren, and fellow diarist Samuel Pepys. His diary started in 1631 when he was 11 years old, and written until just weeks before his death. It's an extensive and important record of one of Britain's most tumultuous centuries. He witnessed the execution of Charles I and Oliver Cromwell, the restoration of the monarchy, the Great Plague and the Great Fire of London. Evelyn's greatest literary triumph was Silver, or A Discourse of Forest Trees and the Propagation of Timber in His Majesty's Dominions. It was published in 1664, the first book to be imprinted by the Royal Society, and reissued three times in Evelyn's lifetime, with a further seven editions published after his death. This landmark treatise on the management of trees began a life in 1662 as a report written in response to an appeal by the Navy, the Royal Navy, to address a shortage of timber for shipbuilding following the Civil War and Interregnum. That it was compiled by a prominent philosopher with a personal and direct support of the king reflects the importance of wood in the 17th century society. And that's interesting, isn't it? Because wood was very much the building material. Trees were highly respected because of their use of wood. And of course, ships for the defence of the realm and houses for those rich merchants and other professions, the timber-framed houses of Tudor Britain, were everywhere and reflected the wealth and opulence back then. And of course, everybody else was living in very much, you know, squalor. Around that time, I mean, they were using bricks, but bricks could only be made handmade by those who could afford it and in those areas where the clay was suitable. And these were usually, you know, your Queen Anne houses. So, a little bit later, really. Anyway, sorry, just clearing my eye from the pug of the night's sleep. So, yeah, fascinating, isn't it? I love trees. Always have loved trees. And as a kid, loved climbing them. And as a kid, down from where I lived, in Horsham, on the old derelict farm, was a small area, about, I don't know, a fifth of an acre, really tiny, but big, probably two tennis courts. Maybe one tennis court, thinking about it, sized area. We called it the orchard, and it must have been an orchard in its day, but these, a long, long time ago, we called it the orchard because there were cooking apple trees, if I remember mostly. There might have been edible trees, but there seemed to be a lot of cooking apples. And these old trees, and they were venerable old trees, were overgrown with brambles and stinging nettles and, you know, all of the usual sort of briar that you get, undergrowth. But as a kid, we used to make camps in it. We used to make camps, we used to climb the trees. It was a mecca. And I remember we had some friends, they were sort of rival friends. Well, they weren't really friends, rivals. I'm just trying to remember what they were. They were Irish, I think. And we used to have apple fights. When the apples were small, as in the size of conkers, we would pick them and we would be having apple fights, throwing them at each other. I mean, it was sort of primitive man. I mean, I'm talking like 10, 8, 9, 10. I don't think we really played with them. We just had these. I just seem to remember these apple fights, but that wasn't very often. We didn't get on with those lot. My friends and I, mainly my mate Peter Richardson, Julian Millwood, and can't remember who else really. We used to go down there and we used to muck about and play and climb the trees. I would go down there on my own with my Thunderbird or UFO toys. Back in the day, the Gerry Anderson stuff. And there were these pits. Of course, at the time, I didn't know what they were, but they were, of course, tree bowls, where trees had fallen and left a bowl in the ground. And I know now what they were, but at the time, we thought they were like special trenches and things. We didn't really know what they were. And it was yards from the house, yards from the back garden. So my mum didn't care, you know, back in the 1960s, late 60s and early 70s, you know, it was safe. It was a good time. It was lovely. And I was brought up on that. I was brought up, we had a big garden and I was brought up with the orchard. That was one of our places. And then the farmer who died, who abandoned, well, he died and the house, his farmhouse and the farm was abandoned. He had been farming when we were there, and we always used to, we were playing in the orchard, and we'd always duck because we always felt that we shouldn't be in there. I guess we shouldn't have been in there. And at one time, it would have been a proper orchard, albeit small, but maybe just an orchard for the farmhouse. Who knows? Anyway, we always used to duck. We always used to play in the fields, and when we saw his car coming down the lane, we would duck out of sight, go, "Farmer!" And down we could go. He didn't have a dog, luckily. And he died. Yes, there's lots of little reminiscences about that. But the orchard was, and I think that's the calling that I've been looking to go home, in a way. I did a video some years ago now where I went over the where I used to live in Horsham. It's all new builds. The orchard has been built on. I mean, to me, it's so heart-rending to see that the playground of your youth has been built on. And people don't know the heritage. They don't know. They've not been there. They don't know where things were. It's all built on. It's all gone. All wiped away. The memories of everything. And it's really sad. I have some slides. I have some transparencies of that area, of the farm. I don't have anything of the orchard. But anyway, sorry, I'm getting a bit tearful there, thinking about the new builds. The awful, awful. And they must be, I'm just trying to think, probably about 30 years ago now, 25 years ago. Really sad. Anyway, let's Hornbeam. I'm going to look it up in this very beautiful book. It's amazing how one thing can take your mind on a journey, isn't it? And that's why land is so important to us and why I feel that real connection, because it's going to take me back to my roots as a child. Right, E, Hornbeam, is with an H, H-I-J-K, H, here we go. Hornbeam. 227. Remember that number? I'm just looking to see if there's another reference to it here. Because it came under hedges, you see. Hornbeam. Oh yeah, 226 to 229. 226. Such a good book, this. Aha. Hornbeam. I think it is a hornbeam. I'm looking at these beautiful leaves, the diagram of these leaves. I think that is a hornbeam, the tree we saw. Now, Julia's parents have got one. And so when we saw this tree, she said, "That's the same as my parents' one. I can't think what it is." I said, "Is it a hornbeam?" She says, "I don't know." But the leaves absolutely look like hornbeam. What can I tell you about hornbeam? Of all the forests, the hornbeam preserves itself best from the bruting of deer, and therefore to be kindly entertained in parks. But the reason this is, I think this is John Evelyn's, that's right. Each chapter starts with a quote from the original Silver, and then the updated, more modern version. So, yeah, of all the foresters, hornbeam preserves itself from the brutting of deer, and therefore to be kindly entertained in parks. But the reason why, with us, we rarely find them ample and spreading, is that our husbandman suffers too large and grown a lop. What does that mean? That our husbandman suffers too large and grown a lop before he cuts them off, which leaves such ghastly wounds as often proves fatal to the trees, or cause it to grow deformed and hollow, and a little worth but for the fire, whereas they were often taken off when the lops were younger, although they did not furnish so great wood, yet the continuance and flourishing of the tree would more than recompense it. So, the wood of hornbeam, this is the updated version, which is probably easier to understand, is exceptionally dense and hard, second only to box among British-grown timbers. It was likened to animal horn in hardness, which, together with the Old English beam, meaning tree, gave rise to its name. Oh, right, so it's hard as horn and beam is tree. Isn't that interesting? Hornbeam. Another theory, is that it was the preferred wood, due to its immense strength, for the beam between horns, the wooden yoke that was tied together in a team of oxen pulling ploughs or heavy-wheeled carts. Oh, right, yeah, well, there you are. Another plausible reason. You can see some sort of wood. You see, we just think, well, just get a bit of wood, fashion it into a shape, and away you go. Back then, when wood was your material, it was the same as all the different metals that we have. We should use a galvanized metal for, I don't know, a gate, for example. You see farm gates, don't you, as galvanized farm gates. We use high-tempered steel for swords, for example. We use aluminium for lightweight purposes, all sorts of things. And each metal has its own use. And back in the day, of course, timber had its own preference because of its different, like willow for cricket bats. And beech was very good for, if I remember rightly, the seats of chairs. Hazel, perfect for poles because of the way it grows straight. And so on. So I find that interesting. So that's very good. The hardness of hornbeam makes it so tough on woodworking tools that some carpenters call it ironwood. Yes, I do remember reading that. It's really interesting. Now, it goes into hornbeam is a native, locally restricted range in southern Britain and is now distributed widely across the country, although never frequent in Scotland. It is one of two hornbeam species native to Europe, the other being oriental hornbeam, which is found around the Mediterranean and eastwards to Iran. A fastigate variety, is abundant. Is an abundant street tree. Oh, okay. Extremely cold, hardy, hornbeam grows on many. What do you mean by Oh, cold hardy, as in it tolerates the winter, I suppose. Hornbeam grows on many soil types, but thrives better than most on heavy and wet clays. It occurs in mixed woodland where oak dominates with ash alongside small-leaved rime, witch elm, hazel and alder, especially in the woodlands of East Anglia, Kent and Sussex. Huh. It is highly tolerant of shade, although less so than beech, and often regenerates in small natural gaps under a woodland canopy, or as advanced regeneration in readiness for a gap that it will exploit quickly. Oak hornbeam forests, where hornbeam is frequent as canopy species, are quite common on lowland fertile soils in Western Europe, but rare in Britain. An example is the Blean in Kent. I don't know where that is. Further east, in Central Europe, extensive lime hornbeam forests can be found. Now, if we took a cutting, can you grow trees from cuttings? That's what I would like to know. Or the seeds. Well, seeds, of course, would be great. It would be nice to have hornbeam, this iron beam horn, on our land when we get it. That would be good, wouldn't it? Hornbeam is tall and slender. Monoecious, don't know what that means. A monoecious tree growing to 30 metres in height. Its bark is smooth and grey like that of beech, but has a silvery sheen and vertical fissures, while its stem is often fluted, making it undesirable for timber production. Also, like beech, its leaves persist during winter, making it a useful hedge plant. But in hornbeam, the leaf margins are double-toothed and turn a much paler brown. Its conspicuous flowers are pendant male and female catkins, which are wind-pollinated. Its seeds, or tiny nuts, are borne in pairs at the base of a three-lopped papery bract. I'm going to the picture. I wish I could show you the picture. This is a line drawing, but it's obviously a line drawing from a real thing. The artwork in this book is just so sublime. It really is. The pen and ink, it's so beautiful, and it's on this very thick paper. It's just lovely. Anyway, there's hornbeam. And I think that's it. So, but if ever I see that tree again, but yeah, we were just debating it. Anyway, I probably waffled on ages. Yes, I have. I'm so sorry. Let's get on and do stuff. But thank you for listening. If you did, I do apologise that this is so long. Till next time, toodle pip.